On Tuesday, April 16th at 10 p.m.,
Sugar in My Bowl presents poet, writer, commentator, and activist Nikki Giovanni. Join us as we discuss moments in her career and her latest novel, Chasing Utopia.
From August 2014, that's Tuesday, April 16th at 10 p.m.,
right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
I want a little sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh, so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is Ms. Nikki Giovanni. Stay tuned for a very enjoyable conversation
from August 2014.
As mentioned, we will be discussing her latest book, Chasing Utopia. Our playlist should be up on the website. It is at sugarinmybowl.org. That's sugarinmybowl.org. Just look for the playlist. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, coming up now.
Maybe I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
I was born in the Congo. I walked to the Fertile Crescent and built the Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine, perfect light. I am bad. I sat on the throne drinking nectar with Allah. I got hot and sent an ice age to Europe to cool my thirst. My oldest daughter is Nefertiti. The tears from my birth pains created the Nile. I am a beautiful woman. I gazed on the forest and burned out the Sahara Desert. With a packet of goat's meat and a change of clothes, I crossed it in 2 hours. I'm a gazelle, so swift, you can't catch me. For a birthday present when he was 3, I gave my son, Hannibal, an elephant. He gave me Rome for Mother's Day. My strength flows ever on. My son, Noah, built New Ark, and I stood proudly at the helm as we sailed on a soft summer day. I turned myself into myself and was Jesus. Men intone my loving name. All praises, I am the one who would say. I sowed diamonds in my backyard. My bowels deliver uranium. The filings from my fingernails are semi-precious jewels. On a trip north, I caught a cold and blew my nose, giving oil to the Arab world. I am so hip, even my errors are correct. I sailed west to reach east and had to round off the earth as I went. The hair from my head thinned and gold was laid across 3 continents. I am so perfect, so divine, so ethereal, so surreal. I cannot be comprehended except by my permission. I mean, I can fly like a bird in the sky.
Thank you so much for allowing me to call you and for us to do this. Is there a baby in there?
There's a baby here, yes.
Oh, right. We won't talk
about
the baby.
I can't do much about the baby.
Can you talk about the baby?
She's a nice baby, and she's learning to potty, and she does. She's really nice. She likes applesauce, so her mom is giving her some applesauce,
sure,
and that'll keep her occupied.
Is this a grandchild?
No, my grandchild is 9 years old. She knows how to sit quietly.
My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Nikki Giovanni.
Nikki Giovanni, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. There are a few things I'd like to talk to you about. We will eventually start talking about Chasing Utopia, because we have to.
I like Chasing Utopia.
I know you do. But there's one thing I do want to know, because I've fallen in love with this person. Tell me about Virginia Fowler.
She's my friend. I've known Virginia for, I don't know, 28 years now. She runs my calendar, and we teach together. She recruited me to Virginia Tech. She was a Jamesian, Henry James specialist, and she's now switched over to African-American Lit. She was the department associate chair, and she is now back to that position. She gave it up for a while because she's diabetic and she was not doing well. But she has come through that very, very well, and she's a friend. I don't know what else to say. Really quite bright person and very nice.
And I'd like to thank her very much for making sure that we're able to have this conversation right now.
Yeah, she runs the calendar, so that's what she does.
She runs it really well, because I had never interacted to arrange for an interview or conversation with someone, and it happened so quickly.
I know too well that I'm just wasting precious time in thinking such a thing could be, that you could ever care for me. I'm sure you hate to hear that I adore you, dear, but grant me just the same, I'm not entirely to blame. To love.
kind of busy, you know, with the death of Maya and then the death of Ruby Dee. It's been a difficult couple of weeks, and that's the truth. But she's very efficient. She gets things done, and I really appreciate that, and I'm very lucky to have her help.
Well, now that you raised the transition of Maya Angelou and Ruby Dee, I just have to ask you, how has that affected you?
You know, it takes a minute to really deal with it. I was talking to Miss Clay yesterday. Miss Clay is to Maya what Jenny is to me.
Okay.
And I was just saying to her, there's a hole in my heart. And I was down in Charlotte. I had to be down in Charlotte. And you never go to Charlotte without stopping off in Winston-Salem and, you know, saying hi to Doc. And it was just the strangest thing to come home and not make that detour, you know? And we knew that she was not well, so I'm not going to be the person that's going to try to act like, oh, my God, you know, this was such a surprise.
Right.
Every time you saw her, she had lost a considerable amount of weight. And you knew that there was a clock ticking, but you never really thought that it would stop. You know, you just thought, well, we have a little more time, a little more time, a little more time.
Right. And then not long after, Ruby Dee transitioning.
Well, Ruby really did surprise me because, you know, the old folks say that death comes in threes. And for me personally, the person that I've known longest in my life that's not kin to me was a nun. She taught me in the sixth grade, named Sister Althea. And she died in April. And then Maya died. And so Jenny had said to me, you know, ooh, you know, I don't know what this third is, because we were talking about, you know, death comes in threes. And we were thinking of the people we knew who were sick. And I know two people who are in their late 90s. And so we're not trying to bury anybody, but, you know, just saying, well, so-and-so is 94,
right,
and somebody else is 97. So, you know, well, we're probably going to lose them, and we need to start preparing ourselves. And we looked around, it was Ruby. When she's 92, so it wasn't like, you know, my goodness, you know, somebody's robbing the cradle here. But I knew that she had been on dialysis for several months, actually. But, again, I was hoping that she would come through. And Ruby was quite a friend. She and Nora were quite a friend. So I've known Ruby for forever. She's my sorority sister. And to say how do you, you miss people. You miss them. Yeah.
This year, actually, for me, there was Amiri Baraka transitioning was starting off the year.
He was the first.
Right.
And again, that was, again, Baraka, I knew he wasn't well, but I didn't know he was that sick.
Right.
Because we celebrated Toni Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
And Baraka's very close to Toni. And he got to the airport and couldn't come, just could not make it. And I said to Jen, oh, you know, we know that he's not doing well because he would have done anything to be here for Toni. It's one of those kind of like, oh, dear. But again, you don't expect to lose people. You expect
right.
that, well, I was sick a couple of years ago, but now I'm, you know, those are the stories we always hear. And, you know, it's like, oh, no.
To sort of come away from
yeah.
that topic.
Okay.
You've often been associated with the Black Arts Movement. What exactly mm-hmm. is your role?
Well, I'm a Black artist. I think that my
right.
role is to do my job. And I certainly am very fortunate because I've been teaching now for 26 years, 27 years. And so my students, we were over in D.C. We just got back from Washington. We were doing a fundraiser for the LEAP. I don't know if you know the LEAP program, L-E-A-P, Literacy
no.
Education Action Program. And it started by my student, Kwame Alexander.
Oh.
And you know Kwame because of, he was nominated for an Image Award year before last. And he's going to be, I'm sure, nominated again because he did the crossover, which got a dynamite review in the New York Times. And I'm so happy for him. Oh. And he's just a great kid. And so we went out. We raised about $10,000, I'm very, very proud to say. And I'm going again with him. I went over before because he had asked me. I'm going again with him to Ghana. So we're very excited. And Black Arts said that we have to pay attention to Black people. And I think that that's important. And I've just been very fortunate in that I've been teaching a lot of really good writers. And so I don't think I can really take credit for their talent. I mean, they're just talented kids, and they just happen to come to me, and I don't destroy their talent. So I take credit for not messing up.
Excellent. The era of the Black Arts Movement, I think, what is it, 66, 65, 66, 68,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
70s? You know, nobody had really thought about Black people.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to give a lot of credit. Of course, the writers did a lot, and I was a part of that group. But we have to give a lot of credit to things like Soul,
sure.
the television show, Ellis Hazlett. And when Ellis started Soul, there were no Blacks on TV. And then he did that, and then Toni
Brown
did Toni Brown's Journal, and he started to do that. And the guy who just died, who committed suicide,
Don Cornelius.
Don Cornelius.
Mm-hmm.
So these people hadn't been on before Ellis did that.
Right.
And Ellis not only brought us, I worked with Ellis in all of these shows, not only got the people on TV, but actually, you know, had people there to comb their hair and do the makeup and, you know, treat them like stars, like what they were. And that became very good because everybody was on Soul. You know, it was like a black Ed Sullivan.
That's true. And then some.
And then some. The politicians, he had, I remember when Baraka came on, you know, because Baraka wasn't sure, speaking of Imamu, wasn't sure that he wanted to be on Soul. He thought it was kind of commercial. Mm. And it's like, yeah, it might be, but, you know, you're still Baraka and you have to talk to your people.
That leads me into my curiosity about your volunteering with Soul.
Ellis came by my home because he needed some advice, and, you know, he had heard of me, and he called me. I say yes to everything. Mm-hmm. So when he called, he came over, and we talked, and I said, you know, I'd be happy to help. Some people, when people pay you, you sometimes lose your voice. And so I knew that I didn't want to be paid as a consultant because what I know about television is limited. What I know about art is much wider. And so I did. I volunteered. And it was important because ultimately after the second year, he knew he owed me. And after the third year, he was going to have to pay up. And so when he said, you know, okay, what do you want? And I said, I want Angela Davis because she was just getting out of jail. I said, I want to interview Angela Davis. But we could not work that out. Angela was just tired. I mean, you know, she wanted to go away. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, we can't, and we worked on that. I do know Angela now. I said, you know, girl, I wanted to be the first person to interview her. I really, really did.
Sure.
But we couldn't work that out. And so he said, well, we can't do that. What else? And I said, well, of course, I'd love to talk to James Baldwin. And he said, I know Jimmy. And it was like, whoa. And so he called, and Baldwin was like, yeah, you know. But Jimmy was busy. And he said, I don't have time to come back to the States. Would she mind coming to London? And I was like, you have got to be kidding. I would swim to London to talk to Jimmy Baldwin. So that's how we got that show. And, of course, that became one of the most popular shows because we actually were filming for an hour. We ended up filming way more than that, and it became a two-hour show, part one and part two, and we got a book out of it, which was nice. But it was just lovely for a junior, upcoming sort of writer like myself to be able to talk to James Baldwin, you know, sit down on the one-on-one, and that was wonderful.
Did you officially study for journalism? I mean, you got the journalist title.
No, I was a history major.
Okay.
That's what I studied, and I think, and I mean no disrespect to any journalist who's listening, you know, that's something, you can learn the journalism, but you have to know your history.
Right.
And I was a history major, and that was important, at least to me, what I know is important. Because otherwise, you know, you end up, you know that the camera angle does this, that, and the other, but you don't know if somebody's telling you. It's like looking at a stupid movie like, you know, 12 Years a Slave. Whoever wrote that doesn't have any sense of history. They have a sense of movies because you got angles and you got lighting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie sucks.
Okay, now that you've said it, what sucks about the movie for you?
First of all, it was an insult. The first black man in his right mind would go off with two strange white men while his wife takes the kids and goes up to, what, Boston or something?
Mm-hmm.
And then he ends up eating with them, which we know is not possible. We know that during that era of segregation, black men and white men don't sit down and eat together, let alone drink together. And the next thing you know, he's being sold. What kind of sense does that make?
They're claiming that they were eating together in the North.
Where in the North? I'm so sorry. No, it's stupid. And then you ended up, he's down there on the plantation, and he's the one that's going to show the white man, you know, this is how you actually going to clear this land, and we're going to do this, that, and the other. And would you mind, by the way, writing a letter and letting everybody know that I'm free? What the hell is that? I mean, it made me totally crazy. But what I do know could never have happened. He wasn't going to whip that girl. And we talk about Uncle Tom. We have allowed people to take Uncle Tom and make it a pejorative term. But the reason Uncle Tom was whipped to death is that he wouldn't tell on Liza, and she was able to escape. If you recall the story.
Of Uncle Tom's cabin, yeah.
Uncle Tom's cabin. He did not let them know where she was, and so she was able to be free. She crossed the Ohio River. And then we have this Negro, 12 years a slave, who finally gets this preacher to write a note, and they say, oh, yeah, let's go get him. And then he not only whips that girl, because the master says to him, well, if you don't whip her, I'm going to kill everybody. Then he would have had to kill everybody, because he can't do that. And I can't even imagine it. It's ahistorical.
Okay.
It is. There's nothing there that says that would happen. Hmm. This man is not going to do that. And then when they come and get him, he's just going to wave goodbye. Sorry, baby. See you later. You know, you take a movie like The Defiant Ones. Remember The Defiant Ones?
Yes, with Tony Curtis.
Uh-huh. And you remember at the end of The Defiant Ones, Tony Curtis breaks his leg.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't get on. The train is going.
Right, right.
And he can't get on.
And
what did
Poitier
do?
Tries to help him.
What did he do?
They both fell, didn't they, from the train?
No, he got off the train. He was on the train.
Right, and he felt he got off the train.
He got off. He could not leave his friend.
Right, right.
Now, you're going to tell me Sidney Poitier is not going to leave Tony Curtis, right, but this Negro is going to leave that black woman? You understand what I'm saying? That's not going to happen. Oh, it made me crazy. Or as you can see, it made me absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
It went against everything we know about the people who helped each other move north. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
And that's why you have to know something, because knowing the camera angle and knowing how to cut a scene has nothing to do with knowing the history that you're supposed to be presenting.
Africa is a young man bathing in the back of a prison fortress. The guide said, "Are you Afro-American? Cape Coast Castle holds a lot for your people. And the 18th century clock that keeps perfect time for the time it has." I watched his black skin turn foaming white and wanted to see this magnificent man stand naked and clean before me. But they called me to the dungeon, where above the Christian church, an African stood listening for sounds of revolt. The lock, the guide stated, indicated a major once ran this fort, and the British, he said, had recently demanded the lock's return. And I wanted that lock, maybe for a doorstop, to unstop the 18th century clock. "And there is one African buried here. We are proud of him," he said. And I screamed, "No, there are thousands." But my voice was lost in the room of the women, with the secret passageway that leads to the governor's quarters. So Roberta Flack recorded a song, and Les McCann cried. But a young African man on the rock outside the prison where my people were born bathed in the sunlight. And Africa is a baby, to be tossed about and disciplined and loved and neglected and bitten on its bottom, as I wanted to sink my teeth into his thigh and tell him he would never be clean until he can possess me.
Yeah.
question is the motivation hanging up the whole damn nation. Looks like we always end up in a rut trying to make it real. But compared to what? Slaughterhouse is killing hogs. Twisted children are killing frogs. Poor dumb rednecks rolling logs. Tired old ladies are kissing dogs. And I hate that human lover, that stinking mud. Trying to make it real. But compared to what? Said the president, he's got his war. Folks don't know just what it's for. No one gives us rhyme or reason. If you have one doubt, they call it treason. I said we're chicken feathers, all without one gut. Trying to make it real. But compared to what? Go to church on Sunday, sleep and not, trying to duck the wrath of God. Preachers filling us with pride, telling what he thinks is right. But he must be some kind of stupid nut. He tries to make it real.
And it won movie of the year, and I thought, you got to be kidding. That's the most propagandistic crap I've seen in years.
Yeah, the Oscars gave it Best Picture.
I don't know when I've seen a movie that bad.
one of the phrases of the Black Arts Movement is poetry for the people. With regard to poetry, it was poetry for the people. Everything, yeah. You know, music for the people, you know, art for the people. And
but it's also the truth of the people.
Right.
But we go back to Dunbar, you know, when you talk about Black Arts, Paul Lawrence Dunbar, you know, we wear the mask that grins and lies. A lot of people, we weren't the first and we weren't the only. But when we finally just came through Langston Hughes, when Langston and them came through the Harlem Renaissance,
right.
We felt that we shouldn't be selling out. And that was the main thing. And speaking of Baraka, he was a great influence on a lot of people because it's like, no, we need to tell the truth as we see it. And that's what Black Arts tried to do. Because everybody's trying to say, oh, well, now what are they doing? Well, they don't like living in the ghetto. They don't like being segregated. And, of course, the people were marching, if
right.
you recall.
Right.
The people were making a statement. We're anti-war and we're anti-segregation. So the people were making a statement. The artists didn't need to be sitting around talking about, you know, I like Bach.
Hmm.
We needed to find the voice of the people.
Well, on that subject, have you heard about Pharrell, the artist who performed Happy?
I love Happy. I was going to say, I love Happy.
Well, he apparently made this statement about that he's part of the new black, and you can't blame your problems on racism or privilege or whatever. You know, it's sort of like a separation, sort of distancing of being black. It's like the new black doesn't acknowledge that. We just do our thing, you know. Well, I suspect you've not heard that.
No, I haven't, but okay. I'm an old woman, and I'm not interested in keeping up with what the kids are doing to that degree,
okay.
Because that's a philosophy. Happy is a spiritual. I don't care what anybody says. Happy is in the tradition. You just listen to it. It's in the tradition of a spiritual. So no matter what he says about what he was or wasn't doing, he was doing something for his people. So it's not up to Pharrell or anybody else to determine what you can and can't do. You do what you have to do. If that makes him happy, good for him, because I like Happy. I really do. And I have a little friend, the girl that you're hearing,
uh-huh.
when you hear somebody talking,
uh-huh.
she's over here. I babysit every now and then. And she loves Happy. And she said, if you're happy, sing along, you know, and I love it. She may never know Pharrell,
mm-hmm.
and Pharrell may be an idiot. I don't know this child,
uh-huh.
but I know that he produced something that is in the tradition of his people. And that's the job of the critics. That's people like me. That's our job to
mm-hmm.
point out, you know, no matter what he says, because people say things all the time. And no matter why he says it, because maybe he thinks if I say something, you know, like that, I'll get a Grammy. These are not things I know.
Mm-hmm.
But I know what he did is a good thing. And my job is to take the good.
All eyes on you for Tupac Shakur. As I tossed and turned, unable to achieve sleep, unable to control anxiety, unable to comprehend why, Tupac is not with us. If those who lived by the sword died by the sword, there would be no white men on earth. If those who lived on hatred died on hatred, there would be no KKK. If those who lived by lies died by lies, there would be nobody on Wall Street, in executive suites, in academic offices instructing the young. Don't tell me he got what he deserved. He deserved a chariot and the accolades of a grateful people. He deserved his life. It was as clear as a mountain stream, as defining as a lightning strike, as terrifying as the sun to vampires. Tupac told the truth. There were those who called it dirty, gangster rap, inciting. There were those who never wanted to be angry at the conditions, but angry at the messenger who reported, your kitchen has roaches, your toilet is overflowing, your basement has so much water, the rats are in the living room, your house is in disorder, and Tupac told you about it. What a beautiful boy. Graceful carriage, melodic voice, sharp wit, intellectual breath. What a beautiful boy to lose. Not me, never me. I do not believe East Coast, West Coast. I saw them murder Emmett Till. I saw them murder Malcolm X. I saw them murder Martin Luther King. I witnessed them shooting Rap Brown. I saw them beat Leroy Jones. I saw them fill their jails. I see them burning churches. Not me, never me. I do not believe this is some sort of mouth action. This is some sort of political action. And they picked well. They picked the brightest, freshest fruit from the tallest tree. What a beautiful boy. But he will not go away, as Malcolm did not go away, as Emmett Till did not go away. Your shooting him will not take him from us. His spirit will fill our hearts. His courage will strengthen us for the challenge. His truth will strengthen our backbones, you know. Socrates had a mother. She, too, watched her son drink hemlock. She, too, asked why. But Socrates stood firm and would not lie to save himself. Tupac has a mother. The lovely Athene has to bury her son. It is not right. It is not right that this young warrior is cut down. It is not right for the old to bury the young. It is not right. This generation mourns Tupac, as my generation mourned Till, as we all mourn Malcolm, this wonderful young warrior. Sonia Sanchez said when she learned of his passing, she walked all day, walking the beautiful warrior home to our ancestors. I just cried, as all mothers cry, for the beautiful boy who said he and Mike Tyson would never be allowed to be free at the same time, who told the truth about them, and who told the truth about us, who is our beautiful warrior. There are those who wanted to make him the problem, who wanted to believe if they silenced Tupac, all would be quiet on the ghetto front. There are those who testified that the problem wasn't the conditions, but the people talking about them. They took away band, so the boys started scratching. They took away gym, so the boys started breakdancing. The boys started rapping because they gave them the guns and the drugs, but not the schools and libraries. What a beautiful boy to lose. And we mourn Tupac Shakur, and we reach out to his mother, and we hug ourselves in sadness and in shame, and we are compelled to ask, are you happy, Miss Tucker? Tupac is gone. Are you happy?
Such a Like what they think, I'm walking around with some keys in my pocket or something. They think I'm going back to jail. They ain't really on that dope. Let me lock with some thug niggas till the day I die. I know y'all watching. I know y'all got me in the scope. I know y'all know this is thug life, baby. Y'all got me on this melon song. But I'm knowing.
What was your motivation for incorporating music into your work?
Oh, I love music. I always have. I don't sing very well. I'm not a good singer, but I love the music. And so when a long time, again, it's one of those going back, I grew up in the Baptist church. And when I had an opportunity to record my poetry, I didn't see the point of me reading it because anybody can read it. I thought, what is it that comes into my head? And what comes into my head are these songs. I wrote a poem called Nikki Rosa, which is about my childhood. But what comes into my head, of course, is my grandmother's favorite song, It Is Well With My Soul.
Childhood remembrances are always a drag if you're black. You always remember things like living in Woodlawn with no inside toilet. And if you become famous or something, They never talk about how happy you were to have your mother all to yourself, and how good the water felt when you got your bath from one of those big tubs that folk in Chicago barbecue in. And somehow when you talk about home, it never gets across how much you understood their feelings as the whole family attended meetings about Hollydale. And even though you remember, your biographers never understand your father's pain as he sells his stock and another dream goes. And though you're poor, it isn't poverty that concerns you. And though they fought a lot, it isn't your father's drinking that makes any difference, but only that everybody is together, and you and your sister have happy birthdays and very good Christmases. And I really hope no white person ever has cause to write about me, because they never understand black love is black wealth. And they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while, I was quite happy.
So I started to pair the songs with the people that I knew and loved. And I do think it's a good CD, and I'm very proud of it. But I think it's because it's all about love. It was all about putting together things that love each other and that come together, that bond.
Thank you.
listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program.
My name is Joyce Jones.
Our guest for this evening is Nikki Giovanni. What you're listening to right now is Ahmad Jamal from Poinciana. And it's live at the Persian, but not for me. And this was originally recorded in 1958. It's on MCA label. What was on before this was Nikki Rosa from Truth Is On Its Way. The exact title, Nikki Rosa. The music is It Is Well, and that is from Truth Is On Its Way, a 1993 collectible records reissue. And let's see, before that we heard All Eyes On Me. It was a snippet of the Tupac recording, All Eyes On Me. This is how the recording ends, and it seemed to be a very important entry in the life of Tupac Shakur, what he had to share in that recording. Before that, we heard Never Gonna Stop from Linda Clifford, that All Eyes On Me sampled. Before that, we heard Nikki Giovanni and her piece in tribute to Tupac Shakur, All Eyes On You for Tupac Shakur. Before that, we heard Compared to What? Roberta Flack from First Take. Before that, we heard Africa 2, He's Sweet I Know from Like a Ripple on a Pond. And that is yet another collectibles reissue. It was reissued in 1993. It was originally recorded in 1972. And before that, we heard Easy to Love from Ella Fitzgerald. And before that, we heard Ego Tripping from Truth Is On The Way. And our show opened with Nina Simone, I Want A Little Sugar In My Bowl. Stay tuned for more Nikki Giovanni and Sugar In My Bowl. The Bandstand will be coming on with our associate producer, Hank Williams, after Poinciana from Ahmad Jamal, so let's enjoy the rest of that. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for April 16th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar My Bowl guests so you can see them live, but don't go anywhere. Joyce Jones will be back in a few more minutes with more Nikki Giovanni, who's tonight's guest. And we have more listings for you this week. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio in the late set at Smalls on the 17th. Trumpeter Terrence Blanchard leads the E Collective at the Blue Note from the 18th through the 21st. Percussionist Steve Croon leads a Latin jazz sextet at the Side Door in Old Lyme, Connecticut on the 19th. Myself, Dr. Leonard Jeffries, and Howard University's Greg Kamathi Carr are all at the ASCAC conference at Brooklyn's Medgar Evers College on the 19th and 20th, talking about the legacy of pianist Randy Weston. Randy's widow, Fatoumata Weston, will be there as well to offer her insights. See the ASCAC conference website for details. Blues vocalist Alexis P. Suter is at the Turning Point Cafe in Piermont on the 20th. Trombonist Craig Harris is at Brooklyn's Sister's Place on the 20th. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Session series continues with late Saturday night sets at Smoke on the 20th and 27th. Drummer Roy Haynes is at the Blue Note from the 22nd through the 24th. Saxophonist Oliver Lake is at Roulette in downtown Brooklyn on the 23rd. Looking a little further ahead, trumpeter Eddie Henderson is at Zinc Bar on the 26th. Guitarist Mary Halverson is at the Jazz Gallery with Tamika Reed's Quartet on the 26th. trumpeter Ahmed Abdullah's Diaspora meets drummer Francisco Mora Catlett's Afro Horn at Sister's Place on the 27th. Tubist Joe Daly is at Terra Blues with Hazmat Modine on the 27th. Vocalist and multi-instrumentalist Camille Thurman is at Dizzy's Club with Daryl Green's trio on the 30th. Finally, poet Carl Hancock Rux is at Brooklyn's Billie Holiday Theater for the multimedia production A Walk Into Slavery from April 30th through May 4th. That's all this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website, and if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. And if you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The Support WBAI link on our website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our new weekly schedule, we'll be back on air next Tuesday night at 10 p.m. and have updated event listings online over the weekend. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
This is Bobby Humphrey. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
What is your relationship to the music that is referred to as jazz?
My mother was a big jazz fan. And the first time I did a performance, a thing, I don't even know what to call it, in New York, it was a book party. And I wanted to do something special. And I was thinking, like, okay, because, you know, if you just do a book party in the bookstore, what do you have? Nothing. And I thought, wow. My mother was alive then. My mommy died now, almost 10 years ago. But mommy was alive. And I said, oh, I think mommy would love it if I could do Birdland. And So I knew that Birdland was owned by Lloyd Price. I don't know if you remember Lordy, 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 Miss Lordy?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Lloyd Price and his partner, Harold Logan. And Birdland, at that point, it's moved now, but it was at like 53rd and Broadway. And so I just went down one afternoon, because there's nothing else to do, and asked if Mr. Logan would give me an appointment at some point. And Harold is like, you know, come on in, because he's a gangster. He ultimately got shot on Broadway, by the way.
Okay.
But, yeah, and I was sorry about that, because I enjoyed working with Harold. And I said, you know, Mr. Logan, I'm a poet. And he, I know you are, because he had seen me on Soul. Mm-hmm. And I told him what I wanted to do. And he said, yeah. He said, well, I could do that probably $400 or $500. You know, he was going, you know, because that's what he does. And I said, Mr. Logan, I don't have any money. And he just looked at me, because I didn't. I'm just a poet. I don't have any money. He said, well, what can you offer? And I said, what do you need? What would it take for you to let me have? Because Sunday is a closed day in New York at that point. So what would you need to open the show? And he said, because he always called me Giovanni. Giovanni, bring me 100 people and you can have it. I get the bar and you know, whatever else you get the rest of. Mm-hmm. He said, 99 people and you'll owe me $500.
Oh.
What you think? I said, I think I can get 100 people to come on a Sunday afternoon to Birdman. And I agree. We shook hands because, you know, he's a gangster and I'm not. And his office is down. So I don't know what you know, but it's down. You know how New York things are down? You do.
Uh-huh.
And so I walked up into the sunlight and it dawned on me. I had just made a pact with a gangster who would try to kill me. My first thing that I did was WBAI and then WWRL.
Okay.
And I started doing late night radio. And because the book was called Black Judgment. So my tagline was Black Judgment is coming. And people just started saying that around town, Black Judgment is coming. And so that Sunday, the New York Times, because, you know, the New York Times is at 42nd, and they saw people starting to line up. And so they sent a reporter down to find out what's going on. And the people in the line said, Black Judgment is coming. And so now the New York Times, the guy's looking for me. He says, you know, he finally found me. He said, I'm looking for Nick Giovanni. I said, well, I'm Nicky Giovanni. I'm not aware of a Nick Giovanni. Well, where is he? I said, I'm a girl. If you're looking for me, it's another thing. He said, what is this? I said, it's Black Judgment. I made the second newsprint of New York Times.
Wow.
And so that was just going to be one thing. My mother loved it because we're jazz people. And my sister was a good friend of Ella Fitzgerald. I met and really loved Ahmad Jamal. And, of course, I know Ramsey Lewis, but I'm a jazz person. I mean, even the people I don't know. And the music is incredible. And there's probably not a song written, you know, between 1920 and 1950 that I don't know.
Did you have, quote, jazz artists at the...
No.
Okay.
Oh, no. I didn't have any money.
Right.
But we had readers. Morgan Freeman, who was my neighbor at that point, he read for me. Barbara Ann Peer read for me.
Wow.
Larry Neal read for me.
Okay.
Amanda Ambrose read for me. I don't know if you remember Amanda. She's a singer from Chicago. But Amanda was in town. I used to babysit. Amanda had four sons, and I used to babysit for her. And so she was in town, so she came over. So we had a really lovely, lovely, lovely afternoon, and Mr. Logan was very pleased. I was glad, believe me.
And you were able to live another day.
And I was able to live another day.
Now, you have the piece that I asked you to read.
Mm-hmm.
Could you please read it?
I can.
Okay.
Let me find my way around that kitchen. It's called I Am Jazz. I am jazz. I am smooth, but not pop. I am cool, but not contained. I run the soundtrack of your life. You enter me with dissonance, then command a little rag. There may even be a prayer or two somewhere in there. I am jazz. When you are alone, I come to you, giving you rhythm to work and rhyme to care. I agree with pure jazz. I am safe for your dog, cool for your cats, salt in the pond for your fish. You need me. Admit it. You need me.
Thank you. Thank you so much for reading
it. I love it.
I love it, too. I was like, I could just hear you reading it when I read it. When did you write that?
This is actually in the book Bicycles. Okay. So it was recent. Bicycles was 2008, 2009, something like that. But I've written a lot about music because I do. I love music, and my mother was a music lover. And when we got to Bicycles, Mommy died. And the book that I wrote actually about her death and dealing with that was a book called Acolytes. And so Acolytes, to me, it's a wonderful book, but I was reviewing a lot of loss. And then I was trying to cheer myself up. And when I was a little girl, your mother teaches, I don't know who taught you, but my mother taught me to ride a bike. And that's when women who had children didn't work, no matter how poor you were. And so Mommy, my older sister, Gary, I have one older sister, and she has passed also. But Gary had a sidewalk, but it's called a sidewalk sickle. They don't make them anymore because now they make bicycles with training wheels, which I think is stupid because they never learned to really ride. But that's another discussion. But Gary had graduated to a big bike, so I inherited the sidewalk sickle. And Mommy said to me one day, so it was before school. I don't know. I must have been four. Couldn't have been any older in kindergarten. Come on, Mickey, I'll teach you to ride a bike. And so I went down, and you know how people used to run behind you? And she had let me go. She was a smoker. And she had let me go, and I was going on. And all of a sudden, I realized she wasn't behind me, and I fell. And Mommy had I was a sucker for that my whole life. She said, come here and I'll pick you up. I said, Mickey, come here and I'll pick you up. And I was about to cry and I was like, oh, okay, if I go, Mommy will pick me up. I did that my whole life. So in trying to adjust to the loss of my mother, I thought, of course, of bicycles because it takes balance and trust. And then I was laughing because Mommy was a beer drinker. So she had habits. As you could hear in your audience, she had bad habits. But beer is not a bad habit. But I don't like beer. And I was really very sad when Mommy died. I'm a mama's girl. And the dog and I were every day getting up and getting a glass of Chardonnay and then about 4 o'clock in the afternoon switching to red and then passing out and waking up the next morning because I was just being really sad after I got done. And one day the dog is looking at me. Her name is Alex. And Alex is looking at me like, you know, again, Mickey, you got to stop this. And I looked at, you know, you can't embarrass your dog. So I was like, okay, Alex. And we went up to the bookstore because I don't like beer. I said, why don't we drink a beer for the old girl? Mm. You know, just to kind of close it out. And I went up to the bookstore, and I wanted the number one beer in the world. Since I don't like beer, I didn't want to drink a cheap beer. You know, I didn't want a Miller Lite or some crap. And the number one beer in the world, of course, is Utopia.
Which leads us to your book, Chasing Utopia.
Chasing Utopia. And I will admit, before you ask, I don't know why it wasn't Seeking Utopia or Looking for Utopia. I don't know. I don't know why I was chasing Utopia.
Okay.
I started to try to find Utopia. And it turned out to be more fun because I had everybody looking for Utopia because it's very hard. It's $350 a pint, and it's very hard. It's only brewed every other. It's a Sam Adams, though, and it's only brewed every other year.
Okay.
So Utopia, this is 14. There'll be another Utopia in 15. There was no Utopia in 14. It's 13, 15, then 17. Yeah.
Did you ever get it, by the way?
When I started doing what I'm doing now, I started, you know, really just bitching. I'm on the radio. And I'm just really bitching that I can't find Utopia. And finally, the brewmeister at Sam Adams must have heard it someplace. And he called into the station and said, tell Dr. Giovanni we are sending her a Utopia and the glasses to drink it out of. Because it's really like a brandy. It was wonderful. It was just wonderful.
Because I know you say you don't like beer. You're not really a beer
drinker. No, I don't like. But it really is more like a brandy. It's got this backbite of butterscotch.
Oh.
Really delicious. Really delicious. But it's very potent, too. It's like, you know, 800. I mean, you know, you sip a little bit of that, and that's about all you can handle.
So how did you collect the short stories and recipes and poetry and what have you that is included in Chasing Utopia?
Well, again, it's probably really my most family book because I went back and just remember, you know, my sister and me. I just remembered things that were interesting to me, and I just thought I'll share it and see, you know, if somebody likes it. Everybody has family. Everybody has people we love, and everybody misses somebody. And so I just wanted to share it. I'm a foodie, and so, of course, being a foodie, it's always you have to share recipes. I'm a good cook, too, by the way.
Okay.
But, I am.
It's like you're not just a foodie who frequents restaurants.
No. I actually, getting me to a restaurant is one of the more difficult things, because I really do. I cook very well myself, and I've been very fortunate. My good and dear friend, though she has now passed also, Edna Lewis. I would not go to Edna's. She was the foremost country cook in America. I didn't want to go to Edna's restaurant because she was down there in Georgia. I would always want to go to her house to see what she was doing. Because even if she was just scrambling an egg, it was fantastic.
Wow. Edna Lewis is probably the foremost country cook in America. And Miss Lewis started the famous School of Southern Cooking, she and Scott Peacock, and she's wonderful. It was such a pleasure to meet her. I went to meet her at Middleton Plantation because she went there to historically recreate the cuisine. And it was a wonderful thing. I stayed a week so that I could eat everything, and I kind of waddled out. The only true lovers are chefs, or happy birthday, Edna Lewis. It is practically amazing. A show of immense proportions, more awe-inspiring, more death-defying, more dangerous than hanging from some very thin rope at the top of a very big tent, more difficult than putting lions and tigers in the same cage, more better than anything at all that mothers cook meals each day for ungrateful children and spouses. If we were fair about it, we would enclose all kitchens in glass so that the passers-by would stop and wonder at the Ralstons bubbling in the Pyrex double boiler each morning, and the beauty of the four plates stacked against the four glasses, tucking the forks and knives with that wonderful, gentle touch of a napkin just kissing the edge. If we were really fair, we would hold contests for the ordinary housewife, who is not an ordinary anything but a working mother, though we recognize immediately that there is no concept of a working father, though we all are told men have families too, so that we might reward the best housewife with some sort of silver plate, and the best house mother with a silver child, and the best working housewife mother with a silver husband, studded with rubies and sapphires and 1¼-carat diamond. If we were fair about it. But this is about love, and there can be no better loving than bread pudding. Oh, sure. I know some people who think bread pudding is just food, but some people also think cream corn comes in a can, and they have never known the pure ecstasy of slicing down the thicker end of an ear of Silver Queen that was just picked at 5 or 6 this very same morning. Then, having sliced it down so very neatly, you take the back of the knife and pull it all the way back up, releasing that wonderful milk to the bowl, to which you add a pinch of garlic and some freshly ground pepper, which you then turn into a gently heated skillet, and you shimmer all of that like eggs. Then you put a piece of aluminum foil over it and let it rest while you put your hands at the small of your back and go, whew. And ain't that love that soaks cold chicken wings in buttermilk and gets the heavy iron pot out and puts just the right pat of lard in it at a high temperature so that when you dust the wings with a little seasoned flour, the lard sizzles and cracks while the wings turn all golden on the outside and juicy on the inside. And yes, I'd say that's love, all right, because the other stuff anybody can do. And if you do it long enough, you can do it either well or adequately. But cooking, now, that's something you learn from your heart. Then you make your hands do what your grandmother's hands did. And I still don't trust anyone who makes meatloaf with instruments, because the meat is to be turned with your hands. And while this may not be a traditional love poem, let me just say one small thing for castor oil and Bic's vapor rub and how's my little baby feeling today after a hard day's work. So, yes, this is a love poem of the highest order, because the next best cook in the world, my grandmother being the best, just had a birthday, and all the asparagus and wild greens and quail and tomatoes on the vine and little peas in spring and half runners in early summer and all the wonderful musty things that come from the ground said, Edna Lewis is having a birthday, and all of us who love, all of you who love food, wish her a happy birthday, because we who are really smart know that chefs make the best lovers, especially when they serve it with oysters on the half shell.
So you were born in 1943 in Knoxville, Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
and then
mm-hmm.
you moved to Cincinnati, Ohio.
Yeah, my family, they were just waiting for me to be born. Yeah, I mean, that's the truth, you know, because my father had accepted the job. You know,
oh, okay.
It was the age of segregation.
Oh, okay.
And in the age of segregation, you just didn't... He was a college graduate, and what could he do for a living? He could work as a bellhop,
right.
You know? And none of that was going to suit him, and I don't blame him. So he took a job in Cincinnati, and Mommy was expecting, and, of course, he wanted to stay with his wife. And when I was born in June, and we moved 2 months later. Yeah.
So do you consider them both your home?
They are, but I'm a Tennessean, and I wrote a poem, which actually I believe is in Acolytes, called Tennessean by Birth. I am a Tennessean by birth, and as you know, speaking of history, the state of Tennessee was the only state that was in rebellion that did not have to undergo Reconstruction. And the reason that they didn't have to undergo Reconstruction, which every other state did, is not because Memphis, because as you know, Memphis, King's still going to get killed in Memphis. He would have never been killed in Knoxville.
Mm.
It was because of Eastern Tennessee and what they did from saving Chattanooga is what saved Atlanta. If we had not been able to hold on to Chattanooga, then the Confederates would have controlled the traffic in and out of Atlanta. It would have been a whole other thing. Sherman could not have had his march to the sea. And so the history, and it's a fabulous history, and I'm always amazed that people don't spend more time just kind of looking at what happened and when and why.
In Chasing Utopia, you said it's a personal book. Go into everyone in your family and your remembrances and things of that nature?
To me, it's a happy book.
Yes.
So it's not a book that I'm, you know, dealing with, oh my goodness, you know, on Thursday I was sad. You know, it's a book that really does celebrate who we are and how we got to be there. And so I'm very proud of it. And it's fun. You know, we were talking about Maya earlier, but you know, Maya was your number one girl in never letting anything get her down. And so we kind of have that in common. Though I'm a little bluer than I think she mostly is. I'm not a blues person, but I can get a little on the blue side. But it's always very interesting that as I looked at Chasing Utopia, Utopia meant a lot, not just the beer, but the idea that we have to find a way to be happy, to find a way to make this work no matter what.
To the subject of jazz again, do you have any personal favorites?
I think probably my favorite is an old Billy Eckstein, and I had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Eckstein. He's actually kin to another relative, but through marriage, not through blood.
Okay.
And I think my favorite piece really is I Want to Talk About You, which Billy Eckstein wrote, but John Coltrane did the definitive. You know, there's nothing to do about Coltrane. He was just incredible, just absolutely incredible.
Very true.
And, yeah, and that just happens to be one of my, you know, it just always makes me just mellow out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's anything we can do about Ahmad Jamal, but not for me. And actually, that's live at the Persian.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's a bad tune. I know that there is not a bad tune on Jamal, Ahmad Jamal, live at the Persian.
If you know. We get the incredible, but not for me. But we also get poinsettia. Indeed.
But, you know, you get, I mean, it's there.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it must be very, very hard. When I met Mr. Jamal, I had to laugh. I said, it must be very hard on you to have done so much at the beginning. Because usually people build into it. You know, they have a couple of songs, a couple of this, and then they get better and better.
Right.
But to start off your career, and then you still have to find ways to go forward, which
right.
he's done. I mean, he's a great guy. And it's always a pleasure. Whenever I'm anywhere, any kind of way near where he is, I go and see him. And he's still fresh. And that's what you love about the jazz people. And I think individually, though, the person probably nicest to me who really always went out of his way to be kind was Dizzy. Because Diz would, they worked on, and these days, I don't know what they're doing now, but 40 years ago, they were going to work all night. And so people like me, being a writer, I'm going to be working in the day. So I'm going to be doing the Today Show. So I'm up at 6 o'clock because I'm going to be on the Today Show. he's up at 6 o'clock because he's just coming home.
Right.
So I used to get to have, you know, we'd be in D.C. or be in New York, and I would have breakfast with Diz. And it was just, oh, he was just the nicest man. He was always incredibly kind to me. And it had a lot to do with how I looked at the, I know a lot of people had not kind things to say about the jazz men, but all of the jazz men I know, including Miles. But I was not Miles's lover, so Cecily may have something else to say.
Right.
But in terms of, well, you know what I'm saying.
Sure, of course.
But in terms of people being nice, Miles was always nice to me. And I always appreciated that because, you know, you're kind of out there by yourself, and it's nice when somebody says, you know, look out for this, or when you go there, do this, or check out so-and-so. You know, it's always nice that they kind of take you under their wing because they've been doing it all their lives.
Well, it sounds like you were really like pals with people on the scene. Is it just that you were all in the same circles and, you know, you just, there was no division of art?
Well, I think first of all, to be honest, I think that they liked me because I liked them.
Okay.
And I wouldn't have asked any of them for a penny. And I didn't expect them to do anything for me. But I do love them so much. And I know their music, I know, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of the old jazz guys particularly were surprised because a lot of people don't know. They know their name.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't know what they do. And so I think that made a difference. Again, I'm a fan, but I'm not a fan like, oh, my God, I want an autograph. I'm a fan like, I really enjoyed what you did, or I saw this, or congratulations on that. You know, you're trying to let them know that they're appreciated. Because I think that anybody that would say, if somebody would call into your show, they would say, well, one thing about Nikki is that she always had this sense of history. And so when I'm meeting these people, I'm making other connections. And I think that that's one of the reasons they respected my mind. And I respected their art. They're smart people.
This is true.
Yeah. And so listening to them, and I said to you just a minute ago, Dizzy and I, and it's true, Dizzy and I would have breakfast, but I'm not a breakfast eater.
Mm.
And so when I would have coffee, because I've never been a breakfast eater. Once I lived with my grandmother, and she believed in breakfast, and I think it got on my nerves. And I don't do breakfast. I don't give a damn where I am or what time it is. I do not. If I want eggs, it's after midnight. And so it was just really, again, kind of just wonderful to sit there and have coffee. And it's because, again, most of the jazz people that I knew, they're used to having people around. So if you're there, you provide a sort of winding down.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right, yes.
And, of course, I adored them. And I knew what they were doing and how they were doing it. It was just, it still is. It's just great. You know, you miss the old guys. I didn't know Mr. Macy, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I'm truly, truly, truly sorry. Because I really, you know, Duke was Duke, but Count was right there. Mr. Macy created some really great music. And
true.
There was Ellington, and then there was the rest of them. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
It's such a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful history.
That it is. Do you have interactions with singers as well?
Not as many singers.
Okay.
And, you know, knew Mr. Ross because he did the Negro College Fund. But I knew Sarah Vaughan because Sarah knew my mother. As I said, my sister, probably the singer we were closest to was Ella Fitzgerald because Mr. Fitzgerald and my sister were good friends. And I also, because my sister was married to Joe Black, and Joe Black was the first African-American to pitch in a World Series game. And he was a friend of Jackie Robinson because they're all in baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through Rachel Robinson that Gary and Miss Fitzgerald met, but they both liked to cook. You know, Miss Fitzgerald was a fabulous cook, and my sister was a fabulous cook.
Uh-huh.
So they bonded over making food.
Nice.
Yeah. But I didn't know many. I'm trying to think. The singer I probably know best was Amanda Ambrose, and she's a Chicagoan. And she bubbled. She never did quite break through, probably children. You know, if you have four kids, it's very, very hard to build a career.
Did she record ever?
She did.
Oh, okay.
She had a sort of small hit, "This Door Swings Both Ways." It goes in and out.
This door swings both ways. It's marked in and out. Some days you want to cry, and someday you will shout. Door swings both ways. It goes back and forth. In comes a southern breeze or cold wind from the north. This door swings both ways. It's in joy and pain. In comes the morning sun and then the evening rain. This door swings both ways. Let's in dark and light. Every day you make the choice to let it wrong or right. When shadows fall, you must prepare yourself for sunshine. For everything that isn't in the soul, my friend, you must be brave. Oh, yeah.
both ways. Which one will it be? Will you live in happiness or dwell in misery? It's so swing both ways. Death in earth and sky. Make the most of living if you're not prepared to die. Well, I said, make the most of living if you're not prepared to die. Oh, yes.
You know, it just wasn't going to be a breakthrough.
Okay. Have you considered recording with music again?
Well, the only thing that I may be doing lately, and we haven't figured it out exactly, is, and I don't know that music will, but, you know, we want to do something for Maya. If I think the writer should, and if people like me don't, I don't know who will. And I'm saying this because I think I'm in a position to be able to do something that I don't have to put a price tag on it. And that's very important to me. I don't want to do a Carnegie Hall concert and that's a $25, $50 ticket. You know what I'm saying? Because mm-hmm. Maya's not here, so who's doing it?
Right.
And
right.
I want to find a way to do something in the spirit of Maya. And I'm working with it right now, and hopefully it'll come off the way I want. Well, no, it'll come off the way I want to, or it won't come off.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's right.
Well, I knew her, and I love and respect her, and I'm not going to be hungry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll probably eat until I die. And so we're going to do some things that the people that love Maya can participate. It's not about, oh, my God, you know, we need to make $1 million. None of that. Yeah.
That would definitely be in the spirit of Dr. Angelou.
Yeah, it would. And I think that giving, I mean, well, she said that all the time. If you need something, give.
Right.
And I think that's true. Maya, by the way, I mean, one of the reasons that I've loved Maya all of these years is that she was always kind to my mother, and mm-hmm. she didn't have to be. And she would see Mommy. You know, my mother traveled around, too. She wasn't always with me.
Mm-hmm.
But Maya always went out of her way. If she was someplace and Mommy was there, always went out of her way to be kind. And I appreciate that. You learn to love people who take care of the people, which is why I was out of the country when she passed. And for me to have gotten back, it was not one of the possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody knows that I was with them, Maya knows that I was with them.
Yeah.
But it was just the kind of thing that you reach out to the people who've always reached out to you, you know, and that was what was important to me. So,
okay.
Can I read you another jazz poem?
Please.
Green shoes, blue shoes, red shoes, good news. Bad news, suede shoes, no ties, loose pants. Pink shoes shining, white shoes whining, all shoes dining on the little ants. Your shoes, her shoes, my shoes, good news. His shoes, those shoes, Miles Davis, all blues.
I knew that was coming. Yes. Excellent. Hey, by the way, had you heard about Miles Davis Way?
Yes, I saw that. I saw that they did that. And I'm really pleased because I lived up in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's also Delta Sigma Theta Way. Yep. And I am one who is supporting, and I know it's going to happen, that somewhere near Broadway, we got to get Ruby Dee Way.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That would make sense.
It's got to happen because Ruby was the breakthrough. I mean, I love Sydney. I've known Sydney since I was 18 years old, but Ruby was the breakthrough there.
What was the name of that piece?
Shoe Jazz, Blue Jazz.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That is great. And where did that come from?
It's right there in Bicycle.
Okay.
And it's because of Miles. Well, Miles was always nice to me, and Cecily was always nice to me. And so I never tried to deal with their relationship because it had nothing to do with me.
No. She came out, though. She came out for the street naming ceremony, which was nice. It was great to see her.
Oh, yeah. She loved him, and he loved her. He's just crazy. He's a Negro.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm not allowed to say that. You know that's exactly what it... Miles loved her.
Yes.
It just, he's a Negro.
Yes.
And so he doesn't want to deal with it in that way. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Yeah. And I know that Cecily knows that nobody meant as much to Miles as she did.
Sure.
Nobody.
Now, I have the last question I have to ask is with regard to the terms feminism and womanism. I was just wondering where you stood on this.
I'm like, you know, Alice, and I'm a big Alice Walker fan. And when I read The Third Life of Grange Copeland, I was in Barbados and I have a son. And Thomas and I were in Barbados. And, well, of course, if you died and went to hell, there'd be a stopover in Atlanta. And when we got to Atlanta, I thought, oh, I said to Thomas, though he's a baby, you know, he's actually, my son Thomas is the same age as Alice's daughter, Rebecca.
Okay.
And so I called Alice, because that's when you could change planes, and, you know, just when life made sense. And I called her, and I said, you know, we're in Atlanta. We think about, you know, I'd love to come. I said, I'd love the third life of grandchildren. Can we come over? And so we went over and spent 3 days with her. And, of course, she has ideologies, and she has things that she does. And a part of it was that she was the womanism and the feminism. That's not me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was really, I admire her work. I am a big fan. I've reviewed her work and stuff. But in terms of caring about those distinctions, the answer would be I don't.
Okay.
Because you can't live your life as an ideology. You have to mm-hmm. live your life as, what can I get done? And I believe that. And I think I'm very, very fortunate in that I've gotten a lot of good things done. And I'm proud of the good that I have. And embarrassed about the bad.
So he said, you ain't got no talent. If you didn't have a face, you wouldn't be nobody. And she said, God created heaven and earth and all that's black within them. So he said, you ain't really no hot stuff. They tell me plenty sisters take care of better business than you. And she said, on the third day, he made chitterlings and all good things to eat and said, that's good. So he said, if the white folks hadn't been under your skirt and been giving you the big play, you'd have had to come on uptown like everybody else. And she replied, then he took a big, black, greasy rib from Adam and said, we will call this woman, and her name will be Sapphire, and she will divide into four parts that Simone may sing a song. And he said, you're pretty full of yourself, ain't you? So she replied, show me someone not full of herself, and I'll show you an empty person.
Thank you so much, Nikki Giovanni, for spending time with Sugar in My Bowl. And
you know, that's Nina Simone. Did you
yes.
give Nina credit?
She,
I
we
want
used,
a little
we,
sugar.
Go ahead.
You know, that's my girl. You know, I was working on her book, on her biography. I have, I would say, maybe 40 hours of Nina on tape.
Wow.
And Nina had to flee the country. This is a longer story than you probably have time to do.
I'm ready. I'm braced. Go ahead.
No, she had to flee the country.
Oh.
And so she did, and we shut the book down.
Mm.
And so now it's in my papers. Those tapes are in my papers.
Wow.
And when I die, because that's who we're waiting on now, so somebody come and shoot me. When I die, that's going to get released. But I put a spell on you as nothing.
Wow.
I have Nina. And I said that to her because she was a good she was more than a good friend. Nina was an incredibly precious woman. And the country treated her really, really badly.
Yes.
And there wasn't much that you could do to protect her other than say to her, you know, it's all right. It's all right. And so when she left, you know, if it hadn't been for Constance Baker Motley, she'd probably be dead. I mean, she is dead now, but, you know, the FBI and them were after her. And Constance wouldn't let them arrest her. And she left that night.
Wow.
I've got hours on Nina. And I'm sorry I'm going to be dead when it all comes out. You know, it's one of those things like, I wonder if I could be dead and still listen in.
Well, I guess where I'm not clear is you. It can't be released until you have transition.
It was an agreement I made, and I don't think the dead come back, but I think that I told Nina, I got your back, baby, and that's all I could say. That's all I could do. So I put it in a safe place.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all you can do. And I'm sure there are things on Stokely, things on Rap Brown, that are not going to come out for a while. And that is why history is important, because people talk to people, but you can't release these things right now because there's still people that are vulnerable.
Right.
You know, this is still the United States.
This is true.
You know, I'm an American.
Right.
You know, we're assholes. Mm. Can you say that on the air?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, we're assholes. And so we have to look out. There's a lot of information out there. It's not going to come out for another 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to really tell you what we did, and we did good work during this period. We helped change America.
When I die, I hope no one who ever hurt me cries. And if they cry, I hope their eyes fall out, and a million maggots that have made up their brains crawl from the empty holes and devour the flesh that covered the evil that passed itself off as a person that I probably tried to love. When I die, I hope every worker in the National Security Council, the Interpol, the FBI, CIA, Foundation for the Development of Black Women gets an extra bonus and maybe takes one day off, and maybe even ask why they didn't work as hard for us as they did them. But it always seems to be that way. Please don't let them read Nikki Rosa. Maybe just let some black woman who called herself my friend go around and collect each and every book. And let some black man who said it was negative of me to want him to be a man collect every picture and poster. And let them burn those as they did me while I tried to live. And as soon as I die, I hope everyone who loved me learns the meaning of my death, which is a simple lesson. Don't do what you do very well, very well, and enjoy it. It scares white folk and makes the black ones truly mad. But I do hope someone tells my son his mother likes little old ladies with their blue dresses and hats and gloves, that sitting by the window to watch dawn come up is valid, that smiling at an old man and petting a dog don't detract from manhood. Do somebody please tell him, I knew all along that what would be is what will be, but I wanted to be a new person, and my rebirth was stifled, not by the master, but the slave. And if ever I touched a life, I hope that life knows that I know that touching was and still is and will always be the true revolution.
Well, thank you so much, Nikki Giovanni. And we do use the Nina Simone version for our theme of Sugar.
Oh, I'm glad. She would be thrilled. I just think that we need to keep collecting, which is why my papers are collected. And so if nothing else, at some point in the 22nd century, if somebody wants to know what happened, my papers will at least show one point. And I was very fortunate in that I almost knew everybody. I knew an awful lot of people, and I respect and love them for what they are. So my papers are going to show a non-ideological view of who these people are. They were always nice to me. That's all I could ask.
Well, I definitely am one of the people who likes to document.
Yeah.
And when I see, I take pictures. When I talk to, you know, it is in a place where it can be found. Do you have your papers in an institution or?
Oh, my, yes.
Okay.
and Boston University.
Okay, great.
Because it's the oldest. And you know, people got upset, and I don't mind sharing this. I mean, people were like, well, why didn't she send it to Fisk? Or why didn't she? Because Fisk may not be there.
Mm.
And what I have experienced, it needs to be someplace that it could be found.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you once again, Nikki Giovanni.
Hey, thank you. This is
fun. I'm so grateful.
Thank you. I'm going to, the kid who's here eating potato chips, so I'm going to go ahead.
All right.
Okay, sweetie.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
and you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. What is playing right now is All Blues from Kind of Blue, Miles Davis. Before that, we heard When I Die. That's from The Way I Feel. And before that, we heard another recording from The Way I Feel, Poem for a Lady Whose Voice I Like. Before that, we heard This Door Swings Both Ways from Amanda Ambrose. I had never heard of her before Nikki Giovanni had mentioned her, so I had to find that recording. Before that, we heard But Not For Me from the Live at the Persian recording. And before that, we heard I Want to Talk About You by John Coltrane. I got this from a compilation. It's John Coltrane Plays for Lovers, and it was originally recorded in 1958 from Soul Train on Prestige Records. Before that, we heard The Only True Lovers Are Chefs, or Happy Birthday, Edna Lewis. And before that, we heard a commentary for Edna Lewis. This is from the Nikki Giovanni Poetry Collection, written and read by Nikki Giovanni. They are unabridged poems, and it was released on, what is this, Cadman Recordings. You can still find it. It's still available. And before that, we heard That's It from Amanda Ambrose. And, of course, before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Stay tuned for Anne-Marie Hendrickson and her mansion with her friends right here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Let's listen to what we can of Miles Davis and All Blues. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.